Backseat Producers, episode 188, Casablanca. Hey, this is Tony.
And this is Tony.
You were listening to Fanboy Smackdown.
It's the year 2005. How's everybody doing tonight?
We weren't even recording in 2005.
Oh, wait, really?
No.
I thought we were recording.
It was 2006.
We were already recording in 2005.
No.
One of the first movies we talked about was Batman Begins. Came out in 2005.
Yeah, but we recorded the episode in 2006.
Was
the second episode we recorded.
All right. Fair enough.
With your brother.
Yes. Yes, gave his phone number out to all the single ladies on Fanboy Smackdown.
Episode number 2.
God love you, brother.
Now this is the Backseat Producers. We are the Backseat Producers. I want to say we probably recorded our first episode, because we didn't release it immediately. I don't remember releasing it immediately. I think we sat on it for like a week before we released the first one.
And
if that's the case, we are probably really close to the time we actually recorded our first episode.
Yeah, I would say that's probably true.
Because we were recorded in April of 2006, and I was actually looking today because I remember there used to be a con in St. Louis called Show Me Con, and I specifically remember going to Show Me Con, leaving Show Me Con on Sunday afternoon, and coming over to your place. And that's when we recorded the first episode.
Mm-hmm.
So I was trying to find something on the internet that would show me when Show Me Con was in 2006, and I only spent 2 or 3 minutes looking and couldn't find it. But if I find it, I will be able to tell you the first day we actually recorded together.
Well, that might be good for anniversary purposes and whatnot. So I mean, it'll be 5 years this year.
Yeah,
maybe it is 5 years. Like right now,
right
like about now, right.
Yeah. Next week we will actually record an anniversary episode, which you know, we planned it for next week, but it might as well be this week since it's just you and I again.
Right.
But no, I wanted to have the rest of the guys on because we have grown from just you and I.
I disappeared for like 3 years.
You and I sitting on the corner of your bed with that stick microphone, holding it up in between us.
Now you know why I disappeared for 3 years.
Yeah, that was weird. That's like the first time you met Adam. He gets to share headphones.
That's right.
Oh, good times. So, we are not here to reminisce today. We will do that another day.
We're here to reminisce about an old film that we call Casablanca.
That is a good way to say it.
Or Casablanca.
Yeah. Casablanca.
So, high-level thoughts.
High-level thoughts. This movie has some of the greatest dialogue, period. I'm just going to say. And I love good, tight dialogue. I'm a big fan of Kevin Smith's early films, where his dialogue was just so tight and so fast. This isn't as fast. The pacing of the film is a little different, but this movie is so quotable. There's so many good one-liners just sprinkled in throughout the film. It's just a good movie.
It is a good movie. I think you're going to be a little surprised what I'm going to say.
I don't think I will.
A lot of the 30s films that I've seen since I've seen Casablanca have kind of framed Casablanca for me a little differently.
Mm-hmm.
When I first saw Casablanca, I thought, wow, this is really good for being an old movie.
Right.
Then I saw films in the 30s, which before, I guess if you want to call the advent of proper melodrama in like the 40s and 50s films.
Right.
The 30s films are far superior to anything in my opinion, was released in the 40s and 50s.
Really?
And there are two movies specifically. One Humphrey Bogart's in. It's called The Maltese Falcon. The other one is
I haven't watched it. I got Casablanca and Maltese Falcon in a double pack for like $5. I just haven't actually gotten around to watching.
Watch The Maltese Falcon.
All right.
It's fantastic. The other one is The Public Enemy, which not only is The Public Enemy probably the best film of the 30s, Public Enemy is probably one of the best films I've ever seen. And it was just amazing to me how much more of our modern film style, like the quick dialogue and the things, and the avoidance of particularly melodramatic scenes that now feel dated to us when we look at, like, Golden Age cinema.
Right.
They didn't exist in the 30s. A lot of that was built into the style coming into the 40s, and one of the big ones was Casablanca.
Yeah, because there are some scenes that, because I was kind of thinking that there are some scenes in Casablanca that do not work in modern sensibilities.
Right,
they do not work. Everything, especially in the first act with Sam.
Yeah,
you just wouldn't see that, and unless it was, and they kind of did. They were highlighting the artist, but even then. Audiences wouldn't stand for it as much as
they did then. Right.
Not only did they stand for it, it was appreciated. That is a highlight of that.
Well, it was at the time when the nexus of marketing films, along with other things like, hey, let's get the music out there. And
right.
The music wasn't written for Casablanca, but it was promoted as, you know, this is the song from Casablanca.
Right.
And it really drove, you know, Casablanca's marketing in a way, as far as I understand. I mean, I don't think I can speak professionally on the subject, but I mean, in the same way that the songs drove, you'd release the soundtrack for a musical 6 months before it came out, right? Meet Me in St. Louis then would come out in the theaters, and everyone would know the songs, and so you go to see the movie, and so it's this kind of stuff that Casablanca is almost the prototype for. And I in some ways feel that...
For 80s movies.
Exactly, right?
Every 80s movie had a soundtrack.
That's right.
You could not walk into a music store in the 80s without tripping over stacks of cassettes of soundtracks. And every movie had, like, pop song soundtracks to them.
Yeah, I mean, everyone take a drink. Even Scorsese had to give in and make The Color of Money a pop soundtrack that could sound.
I actually like that song, too.
Well, yeah, but it doesn't fit with his style.
No.
Particularly.
No, it doesn't. But that was the style of the time.
Right.
And what's funny is you don't really see that anymore.
Right.
Now it's more about the score than
about
the soundtrack.
We saw it for a brief moment with Chicago. When they really made a concerted effort to say, oh, musicals are okay again, and then after they won an Academy Award, nobody made any more musicals. It's like, that'll never happen again.
Well, you had Chicago and Moulin Rouge and...
You're right.
The Neo...
And Mulan. Don't forget Mulan.
Well, Disney kind of cornered the market on musicals for a long time.
Right.
But you had, like, the Neo Phantom of the Opera.
Yeah.
And then there's... And now there's an interesting twist that Disney kind of, not in their animated movies, but in their live-action movies, have kind of pulled musicals back to the forefront.
Oh, I didn't know that.
You know, and, well, they had, like, those High School Musical
Oh, they're
movies.
The ones who did all that?
Yeah, that was all Disney. Yeah, that was all Disney.
I didn't know
so,
that.
Between them and Hannah Montana, and I mean that's
true. Yeah.
And they're appealing to an audience who likes music. They are of the age when their music, they are still buying new music. They're experimental with their music, so they're willing to buy things. I mean, I don't know about you, but I've kind of gotten set in my ways with my music. I don't seek out new music nearly as much as I have in the past.
I still do, actually.
I get new music from the artists that I'm already kind of comfortable with.
Yeah, I do that, but I don't mind buying a new artist. I actually don't even mind. I like kind of waiting until a moment has passed and then going back into that moment for the first time.
Yeah.
Like, for example, like Living Color or Public Enemy are like stuff that, you know, I never would have been privy to in the late 80s and early 90s, right. But now I'm discovering it for the first
Living
time.
Living Color is fantastic. Their musicianship is amazing.
Yeah.
They really are.
They're the pre-Rage Rage, really.
Yeah. Yeah.
But all of that was meant to describe basically my feelings about Casablanca, which is it's not, even though it's a really good movie, and even though it represents a particular time, a kind of a time capsule, it is not as great a movie as it is widely purported to be. In fact, most of the movies made in the 30s, some of them starring Humphrey Bogart, were far superior to anything that Casablanca was. And that's how I feel about that.
I like... there are parts of Casablanca that are uneven and a little bit wonky. We'll get into it as we go. The cool thing about it is they actually address them as part of the movie.
Yeah.
The age difference of Rick and... is it Ilsa?
I think that's her name, yeah.
Rick and Ilsa. The age difference is notable. And they flat out address it.
Well, that's the beauty of having Humphrey Bogart as your main star, is he can deliver a quick line, a self-deprecating line, with all the coolness and suave of the coolest man in the room.
Right.
And so it's not a problem if you have to address those, you know, discrepancies in a film.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So.
All right. So. Let's go ahead and jump into the acting, the actual acting. Humphrey Bogart, Claude Rains,
Ingrid Bergman.
Ingrid Bergman. Yeah. The caliber of acting, and I'm blanking on the guy's name. Paul Henreid. The guy he plays. The cop.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, of course. The Vichy, the French Vichy cop.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And
who directed this? Directed by Michael Curtis. Okay.
Yeah. I actually pulled out the CD. Or I'm sorry, the DVD that I had sitting right here because I had watched it earlier. The caliber of acting was stellar. I mean, what they had to act with, they delivered. The dialogue was crisp. It was tight. Some of the deliveries are just incredibly dry and hilarious. The scene when the Vichy cop is like, because he's been influenced by the Nazis to shut down Rick's cafe late in the film, and he comes out and says, "All right, the place is shut down. We have to stop everything. Everybody needs to leave." And Peter Lorre.
Who's Peter Lorre? Oh, yeah, of course.
So
he's great.
Thank you, Jeff. So then Rick comes up and he's like, "What's going on? Why are you shutting me down?" It's obvious because of the gambling that's going on here. Don't you know we can't have gambling in this establishment? The guy walks up and goes, "And here are your winnings, sir." He just grabs the money and shoves it in his pocket and continues ushering people out. It's little scenes like that that are just so nice because the way the scene could have played out, it could have been dramatic, it could have been violent. It could have gone badly.
Right.
But they actually used that scene to play levity into a situation where the levity actually made the tension even weirder.
Well, it's interesting. That kind of snappy stuff is still in a movie like this.
Yeah.
Even though, you know, I mean, even it's when they're actually interrogating him, you know.
It's really, you know what it's, you know what it reminds me of in a modern film is like Swingers.
Swingers.
Because it's like the quips come so fast.
Social Network's another one that's kind of like that.
Social Network, not as much because actually believe the dialogue. There's a point where the dialogue becomes fantastic.
Right.
And Swingers hits that moment when the dialogue is so fast and the quips come so quickly that the person doesn't even have time to process what's said to them when they are... before words are coming out of their mouth to completely rebuke the person they're talking to. And this toes that line. It's so tight, but you still kind of believe it.
It's so good in a way that is surrealistic. I mean, it's an indelible piece of Americana. That
the timing.
When you're watching it, you're just thinking, no one would ever say that in real life. But you want them to say it because that you want the heroes at that time in that movie to talk like that, to think like that, to act like that. You want them to be cooler than cool. And Humphrey Bogart is very good at that.
Oh, and they... Some of the... They repeat... There's a common theme that gets repeated over and over about just how cool Rick is.
Yeah.
Rick is the coolest guy in the room.
Yeah.
Period.
Always.
And
the only time he loses his cool, if you could argue this, is when this woman messes with his mind.
Yeah.
Because of her extreme situation, basically.
Yeah. And even that extreme situation, you wonder how they get into this situation. And then they fully explain it, and it makes perfect sense.
It's believable for sure.
It becomes believable. Initially, it's a little bit confused and it a little bit doesn't make sense. But by the end, everything does kind of get sorted out, and it really does make sense how all the chips fall. Another great scene is when they're at the open market, and the guy is trying to sell her the scarves or something. He's like, yes, 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 very special deal, 700. 700 for you. You know, and Rick walks up, is talking to her, and he's like, oh, you're a friend of Rick. Friends of Rick, 200. 200 for you. Oh, no, 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 I'll give you a discount because you also know Rick.
Because you also know him.
100.
Believe it or not, I mean...
It was ridiculous.
I've never been to Morocco, but I've been to India, and that is how you negotiate in India, so I wouldn't be surprised if that's how you negotiated in Morocco.
Yeah, it was, that was pretty cool. And there was a lot of humor that was subtle, and I have to imagine at the time was a little bit subversive, because they said... So, the plot of the story is that Rick Humphrey Bogart owns a cafe in Morocco, and he has done things in his past.
Rick's American Cafe.
Yeah. And Rick has done things in his past that he is persona non grata in the United States.
Right.
And they don't get into specifics. I don't remember specifics about why he is not allowed back in. But, so he's kind of set up shop in Morocco. Morocco is a jumping off point for people to go to Portugal, and from Portugal they can get to anywhere in the world. It's a French occupied territory,
mm-hmm.
and it's at the time the movie's set.
It's concurrent. It was filmed concurrent with World War II. I mean,
right,
and they were fighting everywhere, including North Africa for sure. I mean. You know.
Yeah, this film was made in 43, so this was during the war.
Right.
But wasn't it set a little before the war?
I mean, I think the flashback scenes were, but... Well, basically, here's the thing. You know that the
cop... And that was only a couple of years.
You know that the cop is a Vichy French cop, which means that the Germany already conquered France.
True.
So you know that happened, because the Vichy Republic was set up by Germany, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if I remember... history correctly.
I'll trust you on that.
They set up the Vichy Republic as kind of a puppet government that basically was the puppet of Germany.
That sounds right now that you're talking about it.
So if he's a Vichy guy, you know that Germany already took over France. So you're in the middle of the war, and it was a patriotic movie at the time, I mean, for all I know.
Jeff tells us early December 1941.
There you go.
So
in the middle of the war.
Yeah, in the middle of the war... But before
probably right US, after well probably, December 7th, so I mean
yeah, probably, it was probably right at the time,
which probably no mistake. I mean the film, as I understand it, was supposed to be a very important patriotic film at the time that it was released.
Right, and it makes sense that it might have happened right before Pearl Harbor, because there's not a huge outcry from Rick.
Bogart, yeah.
Yeah, from Rick to...
Because deep down inside, patriotic. He's probably a good American, right?
Right. That, I mean, yeah, that's the sense you get about him. And,
yeah.
And that things are changing, and that he's going to get involved. I mean, that's... Spoiler.
Right, yeah.
For a...
Yeah.
60s...
He predates the James Bond white tux also by 20 years. So...
That's true.
So he brings suaveness as a future American spy on...
Yeah.
On every level.
So, he's got this cafe, and in the Moroccan desert, there have been two German couriers killed, and they have special papers. And these special papers, they explain it a little bit, but the special papers, basically, it's an open writ that doesn't have names on it. That if you put a person's name on these papers, they pretty much have impunity to where they can go when they want. Now, if somebody really wants to stop them specifically, they can, but if you're walking through the streets and somebody says, hey, you can't leave town, you flash the papers and they go ahead. These aren't the droids you're looking for. Right. Move along. Right. And
take a drink, Star Wars reference.
Right. I'm trying to work them in. So at that point, I always get Peter Lorre and Claude Rains confused. One of them was the guy who worked for Rick, and one of them was the guy that ended up getting the papers. Anyway,
I don't remember.
Anyway, somebody can correct me later. That's fine. He has the papers and he asks Rick to hold on to them because they're hot. The Germans are looking for him. They know somebody is killed for these papers. And the general assumption is going to be, if the German officials who are looking for the killers find the papers, they'll have found the killer. But at the same time, they don't necessarily want to admit that the papers are missing. So if somebody uses the papers to slip town, then they've lost it. So they're in a big rush to find these papers. And they know that Rick's is a hotbed for action in Morocco, that people gravitate there.
Right.
So they go looking there, and we set up a lot early on with Rick's, with how cool Rick is. Rick has kind of a relationship that he's... It's not even... It doesn't seem so much like a relationship as a one-night stand that she wants to continue, and he kicks her out. There's some random chick. The Nazis come looking for the papers. They get the police officer. Is it Renault? I think it's Renault. Okay. Lorre was the criminal with the papers, and Claude Rains was Louis. Okay. That's what I thought. So Peter Lorre was the guy at the beginning. Claude Rains is the guy who is helpful to Rick later on in the film.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hoping Jeff tells me if it was really Renault. Anyway, because Jeff has been feeding us information. If I had my tablet, this would be all good.
Exactly.
Donate. No.
Donate to Tony's Tablet Fund. Electronic tablet.
All right. So things happen around the bar, and they realize that Claude Rains was Renault? I'm all confused now. Who was the cop?
Was Renault the Vichy guy?
I don't know. I'm lost now. I need to go look this up. I'm going to edit this later. So
I'll have to say, while we're looking all this information up, of the people who acted in this film...
Oh, Paul Henreid was Laszlo.
Okay.
I was incorrect. Claude Rains was Captain Louis Renault. Oh.
Okay.
Okay, so that's who he was.
And Peter Lorre then was the guy that worked for...
Ugarda. Boom. Yeah. I thought he died. I guess not. They must have killed somebody else. I'm confused. Anyway.
Oh, I was only going to...
That's right. I'm okay. Yeah. So Claude Rains was Lou Reneau. He was the guy who was in charge of the police. Peter Lorre was the little bug-eyed guy,
right.
who helped Bogart, who had the papers, who helped Bogart later in the movie. Okay. Now that we've got all that straight.
Peter Lorre, I mean, great actor. I mean, he was in a ton of...
He's that little bug-eyed guy in all those movies.
He's a ton of stuff, man.
Yes. Anytime
he's
you,
awesome.
You see that little bug-eyed guy that talks like this...
Arsenic and Old Lace.
That's a great movie, too.
We got to do that movie.
Yes.
That...
We'll confuse Adam into actually watching that one.
That's one of the great screwball comedies of all time.
It really is.
To me, that and Anchorman, that's really that's really the pinnacle of comedy right there. But anyway.
So, Renault's there, and Renault basically appeases the Germans by saying, I'm in charge here. I'm the local
officials. He has to. He's a Vichy guy, so he has to appease him.
Yeah. He's appeasing them. He's not really.
He's telling them what they want to hear and all that. Yeah, yeah.
And so he rousts the bar for the bad for people he knows are generally dirty people. You know, he does. They pretty much say he's rounding up the usual suspects.
Yeah.
And the pretty girls.
Right.
Which is great because it's almost like a throwaway line at that point, and it comes back later.
Right.
Which is awesome because they have a scene later in the film where he's talking with the Nazis and it's like this really deep, intense conversation and the scene is really tense as it ends, and one of his lieutenants comes in and is like, so we have another one here with problems with her papers. Or something to that effect. And he walks over to the mirror and is like straightening his tie. It's like that is fantastic. Yeah. This guy is dirty and slimy and awesome. And he's that way throughout.
Yeah, but I mean it's not the kind of
he is taking advantage of his situation.
Yeah. It's pretty harmless.
That's his MO. He takes advantage of the situation.
Yeah.
And that character is consistent throughout in doing that. The Nazis come in and want him to shut down Rick's. He shuts down Rick's and then collects his winnings because he's shutting it down because they're gambling.
Right.
When in the end, when Rick is leaving and selling the place, he says, "Oh, yeah, and I talked to so-and-so. You'll still always win."
Yeah. I mean, no, he's a great character. He's a great confidant for Bogart too.
Yeah.
I mean, it works on a lot of levels. I mean, it's well written.
The other great thing is, so after Ilsa and Laszlo come back, Ilsa kind of comes into the bar and recognizes Sam and says, "Play it for me."
Right.
And Sam, there's a great exchange where she's like, "Play it for me." He's like, "I don't know what you're talking about." I don't know any song like that. And so she hums it and he starts playing it. And Bogart's like pissed.
Yeah.
He's like, "I told you never to play this song.
Yeah, yeah.
And he turns around and she's standing there and it's like this really awkward moment that is so great. I mean, it's one of the things that he plays it so cool through the whole movie. It's kind of like watching
Bill Murray in Ghostbusters?
That's not the one I was going with. God damn it, I'm completely blanking. Ocean's 11.
Clooney,
yes. It's kind of like watching Clooney in Ocean's 11, just how smooth and suave he is. And you almost get that same sense about him, that he's just, everybody knows him and everybody's cool with him and he's just the coolest guy in the room. That's kind of the same way it is with Bogey in this movie until that scene happens.
Right.
And he just completely shuts down.
Right.
He just falls apart. She leaves. He gets drunk. He gets Sam to play. "Sir, you told me. Play it."
Yeah.
Just play. And that's another cool thing is that's one of, I guess it's considered one of the most misquoted lines.
Play it again, Sam.
That never is said in the film. She says, "Play it, Sam," and he says something like, "You played it for her, you'll play it for me."
Right.
Play it.
Right.
But there's never a point.
No one says, "Play it again."
Play it again, Sam. Yeah. So that's actually kind of interesting. That
it is. It's just like Cagney with "You dirty rat, you killed my brother." He never said that.
Right.
But you know, in all the movies he's done, it's like. That's like the stock line that somebody attributes to him, you know.
Yeah.
So, but
So Sam kind of, or I'm sorry, not Sam. Rick kind of falls apart, and he kind of goes away for a little while in his own head. We kind of get some flashbacks while he's in his drunken haze,
right?
And it's kind of it's interesting because it's not like a modern montage. Like a modern montage, they would have had some cheesy music in the background, and they would have shown them going through all this stuff. This is, it's a montage, but it's there's dialogue throughout it.
Mm-hmm.
You really get a sense of how they met, what their relationship was like.
It's a genuine flashback. It's not really just a montage. I mean,
it's a flashback, but it's a flashback that is a series of vignettes.
Yeah, exactly.
So they show that.
It's kind of the scene that, it's kind of the series of scenes that starts to stage the melodrama in the film.
Right.
You know, what kind of the film is actually known for.
Yeah.
You know.
It's because this is the point when the film's really about the romance.
Right.
I mean, people consider this, I mean, it's known, primarily known for being a great romance.
It, and I would say that at the end
and
of the day,
is.
That is what it is. I
that
mean,
is what it is, but there's a lot more going on. With
that's
the
true.
With the politics of the situation,
only because,
and the patriotism,
only because
of it.
Romance movies are so bad nowadays. I mean, if they were entire movies the way this movie is, you know,
right?
You know, romance has become such a
interesting,
fickle genre.
What's
it
interesting
you
about this movie?
Film.
What's interesting about this movie? If this was a modern romance,
it would be.
It would have started. It would have started in Paris.
Well, that's true.
Because the modern romance, the formula is boy meets girl, something happens, boy loses girl, then they meet back up, boy gets girl.
I would say it wouldn't
and the
even
difference
be,
is,
if as filmed, it wouldn't be considered a romance today.
No.
It would be considered a war drama.
Yes.
Basically.
Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah, it would have had more action. There would have been fist fights. A car chase. There would have been. There's actually a perfect place in the story for a car chase. There really is at the end when they're heading to the airport. That is the perfect place to have a car chase in the story.
Yeah.
So Rick finds out that Ilsa's back, and she's with her husband. Her husband, who, when he met her, was dead.
Right.
So this is where the story kind of takes a turn for the what?
Right.
You know, it's you all of a sudden get confused because when Rick meets her initially, she's still kind of mourning the loss of her husband. She's
mm-hmm.
found out that he's he died in the early part of the war before America got involved because
mm-hmm.
you know World War II. Did start before 1941.
Right. It started in 1939.
Yeah.
History majors.
So there's the point where we find out that, you know, she is free. She assumed she was free.
Mm-hmm.
And
so they had a wonderful time in Paris.
They had a great time in Paris.
Right.
And then shit got real in Paris. The Nazis were advancing on Paris. They were coming. They were going to be there very soon. As soon as... And apparently Rick was a known quantity, even to the Nazis. This dude was bad. This is a bad
yeah,
dude.
We don't really know what he was doing, but I mean, we assume it was nefarious. Probably like the kind of smuggling Han Solo did in Star Wars.
You know
or whatever.
What?
Take a drink, everybody.
Saying that, actually... George Lucas pulls from so many different sources when he makes his characters and when he does this.
Raiders of the Lost Ark.
I just realized
is Casablanca with a Lost Ark in it. That is absolutely true.
No. Raiders of the Lost Ark is the prequel to Casablanca.
Why is it the prequel to Casablanca?
Because Rick is Indiana Jones.
I mean, in a way, he is.
Because both of them had an affair with a younger woman.
Without the Lost Ark, yeah, exactly.
Holy crap.
Same type of film, for sure. It's the action version of Casablanca.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And it's just a different take on the character of Rick.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, the parallels... I mean, the setting is there. Harrison Ford's character is almost the same character as Humphrey Bogart.
It's Rick, yeah, it really is.
It's just a supernatural version of Casablanca, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
With all the car chases you wanted to throw in at the airport.
Yeah, so that is an interesting way to look at it. It never really dawned on me until
just
now.
I wish I could say that I always thought that. I actually got that thought from a review I read of Raiders of the Lost Ark. That, you know...
That makes sense.
He's a Humphrey Bogart with a tongue in his cheek. Something to that effect. It might be Roger Ebert that wrote that originally
very, very well.
About Raiders of the Lost Ark.
That's how good we are.
We might know that it might be the most memorable reviewer of our time about the greatest movie of our time in North Africa.
But I never read that. I never read that review, so... So as the middle sequence plays out, I won't step through all the individual points of it, but we learn that that Laszlo was he was in a concentration camp, and actually one of the first times we see him, he even mentions it. The Nazis try to question him about things that he knows, and he flat out looks him in the eye and says, "Look, I was in your concentration camps. If I didn't tell you what you wanted to know when I was in the concentration camp, why do you think I would tell you now?" And so he's got his own suave about him as well. Laszlo's kind of a cool guy.
Yeah.
He is fighting the good fight. He's French, and he is he's part of like the French Resistance,
mm-hmm.
and he's fighting from the inside, and he knows he's playing a dangerous game, but his motivation, his reason for surviving the concentration camp was always Ilsa,
mm-hmm.
but she was informed that he died,
mm-hmm.
so she didn't really cheat. You know, it's
no,
one of those things.
Didn't.
As far as she was concerned, you know, as far as the situation went, she didn't cheat because
he was dead.
He was dead, as far as she knew.
Yeah, she's not a bad character.
No. No, though she did cheat, and she was in love with Bogart and in love with her husband, she was put in an extreme situation.
Right.
That you almost... It doesn't play out as well in modern day... You can't get away as well with that situation in modern day. Though, I actually did watch a movie not too long ago that plays against that, almost that exact same
what
type of story. Brothers.
Oh, yeah. I wanted to see that.
With Jake Gyllenhaal and Tobey Maguire.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it plays the same idea. The difference is that they are brothers.
Right.
And the one is believed to be killed.
The Deer Hunter does
yeah.
that, too.
Yep.
So,
yeah, so you almost want to not like her.
I find that hard. I never really felt that
when you're watching the film, when you realize that she had this affair with him, but she's married, there's a moment when you're like, what?
I guess maybe it's
but
because
they pull that
I've
rug.
Seen it enough times. I don't really remember, I guess. I always remember thinking... Yeah, there's got to be a reason for why, but maybe that's because I've seen it so many times.
Yeah, if you're watching this fresh for the first time, I imagine there's a moment of, wow, what a bitch, you know? But
yeah.
they do kind of lay it all out and explain, you know, she's not a bad person. This was not the intention. It's interesting how she still has such strong feelings for Rick, though, because...
Well, Paris was a good time.
Paris was a good time.
They'll always have Paris. Da, da, da.
What was there's a line that he says about it earlier on.
Earlier on, then we'll always have Paris.
Yeah, well, that's at the very end of the film.
Ingrid Bergman is an interesting actress. She ended up going on to star in some of the more interesting neorealist films and Italian cinema and things of that nature. Her career path ended up being, I think, more diverse and artistic than any of the other people in this film, which is really interesting.
Absolutely. Yeah, Bogart was kind of a one-trick pony.
In a way.
That's a demeaning way of putting it, but he didn't diversify a whole lot in the roles that he took.
I saw a movie with him and Cagney in it called The Roaring Twenties.
Oh yeah?
And it really, and maybe I'm just a Cagney guy, because if you like Pesci and De Niro, you're going to love Cagney, because he's the precursor to all that.
Yeah.
But it just struck me how much more of the scenery Cagney just chewed up in every scene. Like, he's larger than life on every screen.
Yeah.
And maybe that's because Bogart played a supporting character at that time, because he wasn't as big a shot at the time. But it's just the idea that as impressive and cool as he was, and as a screen icon as he was, he doesn't really have the staying power that a lot of the other lead actors really did.
Bogart was cool because he was understated.
Right.
He's the kind of guy that talked softly and forced you to listen.
Right.
You know, where Cagney was kind of in your face.
Yeah.
I mean, he was more like Joe Pesci.
Yeah.
He's kind of loud and in your face, and you can't help but be aware of him when he's on screen, where Bogart's talking softly, forcing you to listen.
Right.
So
it's true.
Having two of them, I almost want to see this now, because having two such different characters on the screen had to have been kind of an odd dynamic.
It's interesting. It's not a great movie. It's good enough. I think Cagney just took the role because he didn't want to play a complete villain for once.
Yeah.
So he wasn't in that movie. Bogart was the villain, actually, and they were the foil against one another. But it was interesting, because I was watching this movie together, the both of them, and I just thought, man, I just, like, Cagney just blows this guy away on screen. He just does.
I think if somebody like, I think if Bogart was making movies today, he would have a much better career as a villain.
Well, I actually because think him and Harrison seems... Ford's likeness goes far beyond just
that's
this
true.
Film. I mean, think about it. They both have an understanding. I mean, I don't necessarily think he'd be a villain. He might be the Harrison Ford type hero. Speak loud or speak softly and
he's but he I mean and where I think he would make a good villain is because he is understated. It's hard to act intelligent.
Yeah.
If you're not.
Right.
And you always had the feeling that Bogart's characters were intelligent.
Very much.
That's not something that
he also does a good job of
as well.
Where Cagney is like, I'm a dark guy because I will bash your face in.
Right.
Bogart's character is always, I used to be dark.
Right.
Why? I don't want to talk about it, you know? Like, this
it was
no better
more mysterious,
than,
yeah.
No better than The Maltese Falcon and a film like this, where it's just like, you know, the understatedness lends a mysterious quality
to it. I can't go back to the United States. What?
Right.
What did you do that the whole country doesn't want you? Seriously. This makes him a very interesting character, just with that one piece of information. It's like,
right.
Wow. You're banging chicks nightly. You own your own bar. When you walk down the street, people practically want to give you stuff.
In that way, it's almost like the script is a film noir, but it wasn't filmed like a film noir at all.
Yes.
You got a Spider-Woman, and you got this dark character, and it's like, you know, it's like all of his other film noirs, except it's filmed in like a melodramatic, patriotic
romantic.
You know, lens. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's...
So I found the line exactly that I was looking for, and it was... She tries to start talking to him about Paris, and he turns around and he said, "I wouldn't bring up Paris if I were you. It's poor salesmanship." It's like, and just the way he delivered it is just like,
yeah,
dry, very cool, yeah, and very understated. But it's like, just laugh out loud because it's like, damn, that's, you just got burned. You just got burned bad.
Yeah, there are a lot of good lines like that in this movie. Well, obviously the most famous lines at the end are like some of the best lines.
Yeah, the last 10 minutes of the movie have some of the best lines.
Most quotable, memorable lines, you know.
And easily quotable lines. At one point, Renault says, "Ricky, I'm really starting to like you, Ricky, because you have you're the one person in Casablanca that has less scruples than I do."
Now, is that the line where afterwards he says, "Louis, this is the beginning of a..."
No. There's actually a sequence where Louis says, Rick says something like, "Yeah, I've got $10,000 I can get out of Paris." And Louis says, "Yeah, I guess that's enough to get us both out of Paris." He's like...
Yeah, that's right.
He's like...
Yeah, you know that they're going to be in cahoots together.
Yeah,
after this is over.
Well, they've been in cahoots.
Yeah,
they've just done it in a way that
more out of necessity than choice. I
right.
guess.
And, yeah, and it was necessity, and it was almost like there was plausible deniability on both of their sides. It was right. It was unspoken.
Right.
It was so at you know toward the end, Rick is making his play to get out of town.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to sell the cafe. He's selling to the one guy. He's like, "All right, so..." And when he lines out the stipulations for selling the cafe, Sam gets 25% of the profits. That's the way it's been done. Yeah, I happen to know for a fact that Sam gets 10% of the profits, but he's worth 25.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot about that, too.
And don't forget, you owe Rick's 100 packs of American cigarettes. He says, "I'll be sure to pay them back to myself, then."
That's right.
So so he leaves and... at that point he even says something about... When he talks to Renault the next time, he says, "Yeah, I talked to basically the guy that runs the gambling part of Rick's," and says, "You know, you'll still always win at..." I think it was roulette.
I don't remember.
Yeah, it was something. It was either roulette or craps. I don't know why I'm... I think it's roulette, but... He's just got all this stuff. He's got all his marks all set up.
Yeah.
And there's just... You just know that this is something that he's kind of set himself up here over the course of years. And he's just a fixture. And he's pulling himself away. He and Ilsa have a conversation that, you know, she pretty much says, "I'm in love with you."
Mm-hmm.
"I'm still in love with you. This was a terrible situation. It was only the day that we were leaving Paris that people came to me and said, 'We've got your husband. He needs you. He's just outside of town.'" So she went to him. She said, "Mm-hmm. "I knew I would just be holding you back. If I would have stayed, you would have stayed. That would have gotten you killed."
Mm-hmm.
"So I just left."
Mm-hmm.
"I just disappeared. I did it for you. But now I'm here. Now we can be reunited. He's going to go off and fight in the war anyway. So we can go off together and live the rest of our lives. He's occupied. He doesn't need me anymore." And so then Rick is setting up the escape. And the coolest part about the character is the sacrifice he makes at this point.
Right.
And
that's the famous...
Yeah, I mean, that's
why
that's
you're
the
getting
payoff.
On this plane.
Yeah, that's the payoff.
Yep.
And, you know, they have another moment, and he's like, we're going to go. You know, we won't tell him. We're not going to tell him because he'll try to stop it. You know, he won't understand. This way it's just easier. And the Germans show up, try to arrest him. Rick flips it on everybody. puts those two on the plane. Actually, no, I take that back. Renault tries to stop it. He stops Renault. He holds
the gun
on
Rick
Renault.
Yeah, but Rick insists, basically, is, if I remember correctly, that, you know, she's going to be the one getting on that plane, not him.
Right.
I mean...
And she tells... Well, and then he tells Laszlo, look, she loves you so much that she tried to convince me to give her... To get us on the plane, to get you to safety, and to give you these papers, and... But we all know that this was just a big act. You know? And he's like overplaying it to the point where he's making a huge sacrifice because that was never
right.
her intention.
Right.
But he's telling Laszlo that because he's like, look, this is going to come up. So at some point, it will come up. Why did this go down this way? Because it doesn't make sense.
Right.
Why would Rick just give this up? And Rick flat out tells her, you have to go with him.
Mm-hmm.
He is doing the work of the angels, basically. And
if you don't,
if you don't go, if you
maybe
don't,
maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow,
right.
But soon,
yeah,
for the rest of your life.
And not only will she regret it, but it will damage him and the work that he's doing. Laszlo,
I think it's more about. I really think it's more about her, if I remember correctly, that he basically says, look, this is about you. If you don't do this, you're gonna...
Yeah, you're gonna regret it. And I think, in a way, he's hoping that Laszlo's probably gonna go off and get himself killed.
I don't know, man.
I mean,
the character's too noble for that, I think.
That does cast him in a darker light.
He's not that gray. He is a good character at the end of this. He's
at the end of it, yeah.
He's the old school anti-hero where it's like he's more hero than anti. I mean,
yeah.
You know, like the old school anti-hero was like, you used to be a criminal, but you really always were a good guy.
Right.
You know? Now it's like, you know, he's like, I'm a criminal.
Right.
I'm a good guy because of the situation. It's like our modern anti-hero.
I'm going to let you go, not because it's the right thing to do, it's because you drag me down, woman.
Yeah, right.
You would just slow me down. I like the little dig that Laszlo gives him at the end when basically the handoff of Ilsa occurs. Cause it is pretty much a symbolic handoff. Here, she's yours now.
Yep.
And Laszlo's like, yeah, it's good to know that you're back in the fight. Like, giving him the eye, like, I'm telling you this because this is what you're going to do now, because
right. You
know that's what she would want from you. He plays the guilt card. Laszlo plays the guilt card on Rick.
Yeah, and it's it works.
It works.
I mean...
That's the great part, is that Rick is the noble one, and Laszlo...
Laszlo doesn't have to be noble. He's noble for years.
Yeah,
he's been fighting the good fight.
He's been fighting the good fight. Then he was in a concentration camp.
Right.
And now he still wants to go fight the good fight when he could literally go wherever he wants and just vanish.
Yeah.
He at the end of the film, he has the means to
obviously
disappear.
You know that.
But he's not going to do that.
Her.
That's what he wants to do. He loves her and he loves France.
Right, and that's who he is.
He is a patriot.
Right, right.
He's not a U.S. patriot. He is a patriot to his country.
He's a French
patriot.
So, no, it's... and then obviously, Humphrey Bogart gives the line, Louis, this will be the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Yeah.
Movie ends, you know... That's it?
Yes.
It's a good movie?
It's a great movie. And it's one of those movies that I almost believe that it was made today, we would have seen a sequel.
Probably.
I mean, we would have.
I know. Which is really bad. I mean, doesn't that tell
you
how bad
almost,
things are today?
I mean, you can almost see how it would play out, too. Like, Bogey is like, you know, a commander with the ground forces... For like the RAF, you know, he couldn't be U.S. He'd have to be like part of the Canadian forces.
Oh my
or something.
Gosh! I'm so glad that did not happen.
It would have been terrible. It would have been absolutely terrible. But you know they would have tried.
I know. Yeah, exactly.
And it would have been really cheeseball because it would have been Laszlo dies and he and Ilsa hook back up. Would have been probably the ultimate conclusion of it. So everybody's good because Laszlo's really dead. And he actually dies on screen so that we know he's dead so that they can happily continue their relationship.
You're ruining a pretty good movie, Tony. What are you doing? It's a shame. I mean, movies aren't made like this anymore, that's pretty sure. Although I would say that, like I was saying at the beginning, it's the beginning of an era of film that's so melodramatic, it starts to take away from the quality of the film. I think that the 30s films were much more dynamic.
Well, you know, this was
by
also...
By the 50s, it becomes Written on the Wind, and what's the other one? All That Heaven Allows, those movies, extreme melodrama. It just becomes, it's like... And I like those movies, but they are what they are.
Sure.
I mean, you would never watch a movie like that today, whereas you could watch... The Maltese Falcon could be made today the way it was made then, I think.
Right.
And it would still work today.
Yeah.
Which just tells you that the movie has have longevity for that
other,
area.
The other thing is, the other thing is I don't know. I don't think if they would have made this movie in the modern day, I don't think the ending would have been the same.
Probably
I think they would have ended up together.
Well, I don't know about that.
I think the studio system would have assumed that audiences want to see them end up together.
Yeah, maybe.
As it exists today.
Maybe.
And it's a horrible ending.
But there are films where men and women don't end up together at the end. Chasing Amy? Come on. I just referenced that because I know you like Kevin Smith.
And that is a movie that was made outside of the studio system.
I know.
That kind of makes my point.
Fair enough. You win again, Tony.
I do. 5 years later, I'm still winning.
Winning. So.
Yeah, it is a solid film. It is ultimately watchable. It's the kind of movie that I could, you know. The great thing is I could sit here and watch it in front of the kids, too. I mean, they wouldn't necessarily be interested in it, but it's not something I have to worry about watching in front of them.
Yeah, I mean, it's just really hard for me to separate it from all of the things that go with it. It's really hard for me to look at it as just a movie.
Well, because it's not. I mean,
it's also made
in the early part of the 40s, and any movie made in the early 40s that had anything to do with the war had to have a patriotic spin on it. It was like part of the law.
Right.
I mean, they really did enforce that, and they worked with government agencies to really highlight, you know, that you had to, you know, the Nazis were always the bad guys, and you know the Americans were always the good guys. Even though making Rick an expatriate is a really interesting choice, because he doesn't have to be, you know, a flag waving American,
right?
And that's a really
cool
choice.
I don't think anyone would have bought Humphrey Bogart as a flag waving American given his previous roles.
No, probably not.
I mean, he was basically your classic film noir guy. He was dark past, detective type guy, you know, in it for himself.
Right.
You know.
Which is interesting because it plays to that character.
It plays to the archetype.
To the archetype that he was part of creating.
Right. But then ultimately he transcends that archetype and becomes this heroic guy in this movie. Yeah,
so it was interesting because this actually kind of was... It tore down that archetype a little bit.
Yeah.
It used the archetype to lead the audience in a direction that you thought the character was.
Right.
But then they... during the flashbacks, when you saw him smiling, oh my God, Bogie's smiling, what the hell is going on? He seems happy! What?! What is this about?
I didn't pay.
This cannot stand.
$1 to see this movie? For that?
That was an expensive movie.
Back then.
Jeez.
I guess my only thing I wanted to mention was...
Strippers delivered the popcorn at that theater.
Now I wish I would have been around then to watch this movie in that theater. Rick's Cafe American was a restaurant on Chippewa Street, or Watson now.
Really?
In St. Louis. And it had all the posters from this movie, it had a piano in the center of the of the room. And now it's gone. It's been gone now for, gosh, at least 10 years.
Yeah.
But I know the movie from being in that restaurant before I even saw the movie.
Yeah.
So by the time I saw the movie, I mean, I was like an 8-year-old, 9-year-old kid eating in this place all the time. So by the time I saw the movie, I felt like I already knew, like,
the
whole thing. I mean, it became part of your life, you know.
Before Holden sat down and watched the Star Wars movies, he knew, Luke, I am your father.
Right.
You know?
Right.
It's one of those things that there are some things you can't avoid once they get past a certain age. Anybody who hasn't seen, for people who have not seen Gone with the Wind, they still know, you know, frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn. You don't necessarily get the reference, but you know that. And you're waiting for it. You're anticipating it. You know it's coming.
It's true. Yeah.
And you have to wait a long time to get it. If you're watching that movie, that is a long time coming.
I mean, it's almost a 4-hour movie, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's at like 3 hours and 55 minutes.
Oh, man. Yeah. That's a good one, too. We ought to do that one.
I do not like that movie.
You don't?
I do not like that movie.
That's a melodramatic movie.
It is. It is ridiculously melodramatic.
Very mellow. But that's a 20s movie. It's before the 30s and all that hyper realism of the 30s. So, and then it's more melodrama movie, in the 40s.
That movie, I've sat and watched it with Julie, and I hated every second of that movie.
Really?
Until, frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn. And at which point, I'm pumping my fist and going, yes, yes, suck it, bitch, yes.
It's a huge payoff. It's a great line.
Great payoff. But if you've never seen the movie, you don't realize
how powerful that line is. And that was the first time in a movie someone said damn or someone cursed.
Yeah.
Because that was like a big deal at the time, you know.
And it was a great payoff. And what was even better was the line immediately after it. And he leaves and she's like, with God as my witness.
And I'll never go hungry again.
And it's like, wow, that bitch is totally oblivious.
Yeah.
Wow. And it's like, it's such a great moment that I didn't feel the 4 hours that I spent watching the movie was completely wasted because of the payoff in the last two.
Because Clark Gable got his in the end.
I told her to suck it. In fact, don't suck it because I don't want you anymore.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So what are we doing after this one? What's the next one?
Next week is... This one is actually going to fall out of sequence. Because this one will actually be the one that we hold on to in our back pocket for a little while. But the next week we are recording our anniversary episode.
Okay.
But we don't really have a topic for that. It is the anniversary episode!
Well, what... do you want to do a specific movie for the anniversary episode?
I don't know.
You want us to just turn the bikes on and go crazy?
Bullshit for an hour. Why not?
It could work.
Because, yeah.
It could work. Like, it's any different from any other episode.
Say, we have recorded for an hour and 20 minutes at this point.
Exactly.
So, probably about 10 minutes of it was the Batman talk at the beginning.
Yes.
The Lex Luthor
Batman.
The
important Lex Luthor Batman talk.
Yeah.
Very important.
So, we'll figure something out.
All right.
Because I want to start jumping into some of the other movies we had made on that short list, Godfather and that. We got there's some good ones to touch on.
It occurred to me that since we were talking about it, that the Roaring Twenties might be an interesting one, just because it has Cagney and Bogart both in it.
I want to separate. I want to separate this movie from another movie from that era by a couple episodes at least.
Okay.
Just so we're not doing a bunch of old movies in a row.
Right. Are we going to do Godfather next, you're saying?
Yeah.
Let's do it.
Let's do it.
Let's do it.
I need to crack open my my restored edition of... I got the restored edition of the Godfather movies, but I've not actually cracked it open to watch.
Should we do part one and two together?
No.
No?
No. Do them separate.
Okay.
Separate. Treat them separate.
Are we going to include three?
I don't know. I think one and two is enough.
I think it is, too. It's the original novel.
Yeah.
So.
One and two is enough, and... The great thing about 1 and 2 is the movies are so different that it's technically a sequel, but it's not a sequel in quite the same way that, like, a superhero movie sequel is. Where, you know, X-Men 1 and 2 are formulaically the same movie.
This is almost two arcs of the same movie.
Tron and Tron Legacy are the same movie. Not that that's bad in my estimation. I enjoy both of them, but they are the same movie. Minus the grid spiders in Tron Legacy. It did not have grid spiders. It just had women in slinky Tron outfits walking around.
This is... Now, you bring up another good point. Maybe, now that there's no Rick's Cafe American restaurant, the next theme restaurant in the area should be the Tron...
The bar.
Restaurant
the,
with the... With the slinky ladies.
Oh, what was the name of that bar? I'm blanking now. Because it did actually have a name. But, yeah, that would be fantastic.
All right, that's the plan from here on out. That's what Backseat Producers are going to focus on.
Last point, and I didn't mention this before, and I'm glad Jeff did because I'm right here with him. I felt like I saw Casablanca before because of all the references in Looney Tunes.
That's right.
They were all over in Looney Tunes.
Yep.
Bogart showed up a number of times alongside Bugs Bunny. Yeah, and they were rife with references to Casablanca and Bogart in Looney Tunes. I'm guessing there was some contractual reasons for that. Was that...
Is this a studio? Is this WB?
Is that Warner?
Yes, it is.
There you go. Bam. That shot was not hard to call.
Done.
All right. I think we're done.
All right.
See you next time.
See ya.